Hey everyone, this is Paul Siegel, and you're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs comes to you live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern, and you can catch us on twitch.tv/wanderingdms or youtube.com/wanderingdms/live. And now, on with the show. Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan. Today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about outdoor adventures in D&D. What's the best way to handle big, sweeping action? Hex crawls, no hex maps, point crawls, node-based travel. We'll explore them all and much more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin today's conversation, as always, I'll remind you that at the end of the show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That is a live video chat that Dan and I host on our patron Discord server, and you can join in by becoming a patron. Just visit patreon.com/wanderingdms, pledge at any tier, and you'll get an invite to the Discord server. Get your account set up over there before the end of the show, and about 10 minutes after the show, Dan and I will be there to chat with you all live.
We love talking to our patrons so much. Our top patron Backris is checking in that we're currently live on Twitch and YouTube and Restream, and thanks for that. There's a $1 tier that gets you onto our Discord server, so it's why not? Yeah. Why not, really?
Yeah. Come join in.
Paul, we should welcome everybody on the day of daylight saving time, which everybody adores.
Yeah, I almost missed that one, Dan. I am coming hot here.
Friends, I'll just confess, both Paul and I were out kind of late separately last night. I had friends reminding me that DST was going to happen, so it did not sneak up on me.
Better prepared than I was.
Yeah.
Dan, also, I think it's worth mentioning at the top of the show here before we get into today's topic, we're going to be at a bunch of conventions coming up soon, and I want to make sure everyone is aware and ready for that. We have Rising Phoenix Game Con coming up in April. Sorry, before that, we have GaryCon in March.
We have GaryCon in just 2 weeks now.
Yeah,
less than 2 weeks.
Yeah. And then Milford, Massachusetts, April 24th to 26th. Yeah. We'll be at both of those. We'll be running games. We'll be doing dungeon design dashes at both. What a great time to become a patron, because we are going to be rolling out several dungeon design dashes, Dan. Several. I say several because not just...
I get it.
The
yes.
one that yep. we're super behind on.
Right? Yes.
that one's coming out soon now.
You're doing this on air, Paul.
I know.
I was ready for this conversation off air. I wasn't. Off air. You are coming in hot. Wow.
My point is, patrons, viewers, what a great time to become a patron. What a great time. Patrons get full free access to all of the dungeon design dashes when they're finalized. What a great value for your $1 a month. Get yourself access to the Discord. Get yourself some PDFs sent to you for the dungeon design dashes. It's all good stuff.
That is totally true. And thank you for that reminder, that useful reminder, Paul. I'll point out that at GaryCon in about 2 weeks, the one that's coming right up, the dungeon design dash that we're doing is Thursday night at 9. There are still, so that's in a big seminar room. And there are still tickets available for that. If anybody wants to join us, we would love to join us for that. Now, the other games that I'm running, I'm doing a playtest of that currently unknown dungeon later in the weekend, and some other stuff. My other games are all booked up at this point, which is great. So if viewer, you're registered for that, I'll enjoy seeing you at GaryCon. But we still have tickets available for the actual dash. So join us for that if you can.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. Yeah, should be fun doing two kind of hot on each other's heels like that. I think that's curious to see how that impacts things.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a little extra delight on my end because I spent some time prepping for these, Dan, where I like got the maps out and I got everything prepared. So
yes,
I have a little insight about what's in store for us, and Dan will be surprised as always. So
I was almost going to say a couple minutes ago, try to avoid surprise at all costs, and here I am. Yeah, I'm walking right into it. Walking into the fear, Paul.
Excellent. Great. Yeah, a little punchy this morning, thanks to the time change. What's our topic again? Wilderness adventures.
We're talking about outdoor adventures. If you want to see it, like a large expanse of a big swath of your campaign territory, how are you going to deal with that? How are you going to deal with the very different contextual problem of pulling people out of the dungeon and having them cross, maybe they've got a mission, maybe they're just exploring, and there are surprisingly large number of ways. When I sat down to make a list, there's a surprisingly large number of ways of possibly handling that over the years.
Yeah, I think it's really telling that the basic sets split this out intentionally, right? If you've got mm-hmm. your Moldvay cook out or even your Beckme out, right, you're gonna see I think Beckme, maybe I'm wrong about that. But you're gonna see in that basic set that is just covering dungeons. And you don't get outdoor wildernessy stuff until the experts.
Yeah. You know, I pulled out my Holmes Basic, which was the first D&D basic set. And as far as I can tell, the word wilderness never appears, never even says it. So, which is not what I at least expected him to say, like, and you can look at the advanced D&D for more information if you're interested in this. But they never even mention wilderness. They're like, the game's Dungeons and Dragons. You're going to get dungeons, the end. And the other thing I noticed is that, and that I didn't remember, is that the monster listings in that first basic set don't have any monster numbers. They don't have any number appearing statistic. It's just like, here's a goblin. You want more goblins? That's on you, pal. And therein dodges the whole issue of like, how dangerous is the wilderness after all? You need another book for that. Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, you're digging in there into an interesting kind of mechanical impact of the whole wilderness versus dungeon, right? Was that in those earlier editions, you had vastly different numbers for indoors versus outdoors, right? You had different scales of range. You had different numbers of monsters. Mm-hmm. It definitely, I think the original rule sets definitely had an expectation of a very kind of simulationist style of play as you're wandering around the wilderness, right? And I feel like that's morphed a lot over time as people have tried to build stuff. And, you know, it's surprising to me, I guess, because you think about some of the inspirational material, right? Obviously, there's a lot of Tolkien, right? There's a lot of Tolkien. There was effort to scrub it out of the original set. But, like, what is Lord of the Rings, if not a wilderness adventure, right? It's they trek over vast terrain over a course of a lot of time.
That's a great observation. I like that a lot, actually. And a lot of the most tense action is, can we get from point A to point B, in this area that should probably kill us, and can we challenge ourselves to get through this place where we really shouldn't be going into? That's a really great observation. It hadn't occurred to me, actually. We have to salute to whoever first pointed out that when you're talking wilderness rules, outdoor rules in D&D, the inception of those rules is, yes, you called it, kids, outdoor survival. So the Avalon Hill game from around 1970, and I think we know this was really made by Jim Dunnigan, the legend of SPI, and very simulationist. Outdoor survival is kind of intended to beat into you an education of how you would actually survive in the wilderness. And it does actually come with a packet of real world. It doesn't help you play the game at all, but it does come with a packet of actual outdoor survival tips of how to make a shelter and how to make a fire and how to deal with poison and just opening up, how to bandage, right? How to bandage injuries and make splints and stuff like that, right? This doesn't help you in the game at all, but it is an actual 24 page document. And then, you know, when I played outdoor survival, initially it seemed unwinnable. And then finally, one of my good friends figured out, at least with the initial scenario, figured out the only strategy that lets you survive in the low level scenario, and it's what you should do. It's what it's really? So I'll never forget now how fundamentally, if you are actually stranded with no equipment in an outdoor area, what you should do, because it's literally the only strategy that you can live through the game with.
What is
so
that
very
strategy?
Simulation
areas now.
Yeah. Follow the water.
Follow the water.
You gotta follow a river, even though it's very meandering, and even though it's relatively slow, at least you'll have something to drink.
Okay. Yeah.
Interesting. That's it.
Okay.
Now, if you're equipped, there are different scenarios that assumes a better equipped, more experienced outdoors person. And if you're better equipped, then you can do other stuff. But if you have the low level scenarios, you have no gear whatsoever. You have no ability to navigate well. Follow the river. Right. So that comes from, so we all know, we probably don't need to pull up the rule book again, but I'm perpetually amused that when you crack open the first publication of original D&D, it does say on page 2 or whatever, required equipment, you need Dungeons and Dragons, yep. You have it. And the second thing is outdoor survival. You need that box, apparently. Yep. And then things like dice and paper and pencils and players.
I'm going to assume here and I feel like this is, you know, I don't know what this is assembled from. So maybe there's some weird bias leaking in here. But I'm assuming the expectation is you have some kind of overland map, whether that's the outdoor survival board or not, for your game world. Two, you have dungeons, right? And you have dungeon maps, and you're going to send your players on various adventures on dungeons. And really, the only reason for an outdoor wilderness encounter or adventure really is to just get from one dungeon to the next. That really, this is just, okay, it makes sense for on this map that I would have to go from this town to that town to get from one dungeon to the next, and that there's not really an expectation or maybe... I guess, again, if now we're going to leak a little bit, Dan, into the way you've run it in Outdoor Spoliation, yep. Right? Like maybe I'm going to assault a castle, right? Maybe I'm going to come across a stronghold, an enemy stronghold, and assault it.
You know, but, let me go back to that original statement you've got. Like, why does this even exist here? So the idea of moving from one dungeon to another, great, great guess. Love it. I might be surprised when I crack open the book that that's not the emphasis. And I think that the implication in early D&D is there's probably only one dungeon. There's like every referee owns their mega dungeon in their campaign. And what they actually talk about, what you're going to use it for, is side adventures, which to me says, you found a map, right? There's a bunch of maps that pop up in the random tables, and the maps might say you're going to have to go to the outdoor table to go retrieve this particular treasure on this treasure map. Or just random, like what's called here, offhand adventures, where you can just wander randomly in the wilderness, and it's a very simple system that they have initially. It's generative play of, you just wander around the wilderness, and there every move, there's a chance you run into a monster, and that there's a chance that monster has treasure. That's can totally be it. And the thing that it talks about the most is finding a place for your castle.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, okay. So I'm going to try and cast my brain back here into the little dribs and drabs of information we know about early D&D play, right? We know that Gary and Dave were part of larger clubs, right? A lot of this is born out of these large gaming clubs, and that they were playing, war games, military war games. They were probably, somebody probably had a fantasy set medieval war game. They're probably playing a bunch of chainmail. And at some point, they thought it was clever to draw a large overland map, and each person in the club who was participating had a home region, right? This is me. This is where I am, right? Makes sense. When you're talking about large-scale battles, this is where everything is. And that carried over, right? As far as we know, that carried over into D&D. And you have, right, like Greyhawk and Blackmoor are theoretically on the same map, correct?
I think that's a late development. I think that was, I think that they were glued together at a fairly late era, I believe.
Huh. To what end, I guess? Because I guess I'm intuiting.
It's like a superhero crossover movie. You like Spider-Man? You like Superman? Here's a comic with both Spider-Man and Superman.
That's hilarious. You think that's it? That's interesting. Because we know that the players in these campaigns, right, that they started to, you know, they weren't all just getting together as a super team to go fight whatever bad guys or whatnot, right? There was infighting, right? We know there was infighting amongst them.
True. Yeah.
right. True. So I think that demands a setting, right? Okay. Well, where is the other player? Where in the world is he? Where did he build his castle? I want to send my army to go beat up his castle. I want to send my expert thief to go steal his magic carpet, whatever.
That makes so much sense. And my instinct is that surprisingly, it was in the other direction. Is they had the outdoor survival mat. And like, if you look at Arneson's first fantasy campaign, you know, he expands a little bit about how he's using the wilderness and the campaign. And interestingly, like he uses the words adventure and encounter interchangeably. So the only, at least on day zero, the only thing that you could do with the map is just move, random monster check, random treasure check. Huh. And as far as Arneson and FFC is, that's the adventure. Is like, rolling positive for a monster counts as you found an adventure. And I think that once you have, and you know, for those of us, you know, if you look at those old tables, there's a percent in layer, like every monster has a percent in layer. And it's just entirely synonymous with, do they have treasure? That's all that means. But as soon as you have that at play, then you start thinking about, can I set up a custom location? Can I set up a custom castle? Can I put two players on the same board? And all that play becomes really appetizing, obviously.
Interesting. It's fascinating to me because, I mean, ultimately, you know, what I'm trying to do is connect the dots back to where we started versus where we got to. Because these days, I feel like when we look at outdoor adventures, right? You get a lot of printed material that is that tries to be, frankly, a little bit more like, say, the plot of Lord of the Rings, right? Where you've got there's a big map, and there is reason for you to traverse the terrain because objectives exist, and you want to get from point A to point B to accomplish XYZ, and where everyone else is on that map is important, and what is happening in the world is important. You know, my major exposure to this will be the earliest one that I can come up with is The Enemy Within in Warhammer Fantasy. That's you know, obviously I ran that for the stream 10 Dead Rats. The very second installation of that is Death on the Reich, which I'm looking at right here. And of course it comes with a giant hex map. We have this huge, huge hex map of land to traverse, and there are all kinds of towns and locations, and there's bits of adventure that appear. The basic thrust of this is the players have a boat, and they're going to sail up and down the rivers, and they're going to encounter stuff. And it's a fascinating thing, because even though there's a throughput of a plot, there's definitely, it's a little sandboxy, right? There's stuff at specific locations, and the order the players intersect those is whatever the order is that happens, right? There's kind of maybe an implied order in the book, but it's not necessarily doesn't have to go in that order. And the funny thing is too, it even comes with a second booklet called Riverlife, which just goes over, here's a bunch of stuff about sailing boats up and down the river and a bunch of random encounters and stuff that could happen as they travel.
Interesting.
And it's just, it's not quite as simulation-y as you're talking about. Like, it's not quite what you're, right, we're talking about for outdoor outdoor survival, because, right, like, one of the things I'll say is right here, there's a section that says, very early, when do I use these encounters? It says it's largely up to you, the GM. You can either use an encounter whenever you choose, if the adventurers are moving too slowly or in the wrong direction, for example, or if they've spent a long time traveling and nothing particular has happened. Or you can generate encounters randomly, rolling dice on the encounter frequency table. Use whichever method suits your game and your style of play.
Ran it, Paul, which side of that did you fall on more?
So the fascinating thing, annoyingly, I will say, in this publication, this is, I'm going to say like 86, 87, I think this came out somewhere around there. The tables, the aforementioned tables are terrible, right? Everything is in like these real world measurements. Right, you have this giant hex map where each hex is 5 miles, but is like
just like original D&D.
You got to figure out like how fast does the boat move? And
okay, so this is
there's a lot of real world math you got to do to figure out exactly when stuff.
So this is a gripe that I have. This is a big gripe that I have actually, of I think a misstep that happened right after original D&D. So like in outdoor survival, right? So original D&D takes, you know, at least it's inspired by many of the mechanics from outdoor survival. So outdoor survival, the move rates are in hexes. And I think the hexes are 3 miles each, or just kind of doesn't matter. But they're in hexes, and then there's modifiers for different terrain types, and you roll a d6 to see if you get lost, and you roll another d6 to see if you have an encounter, right? And all of those mechanics were pulled into original D&D, and a lot of us are familiar with those. Now, so in original D&D, the moves are in hexes. And then when you switch to advanced D&D, a lot of stuff in AD&D, and Gary didn't have a co-writer at that point, became much more abstract. And in the past, I've, you know, said j'accuse to the disease rules and the monster rules in places, and in particular move rules, they switched from hexes to just number of miles. And if you kind of read the fine print, what Gary's saying is, well, this will allow you to scale your map, DM, to whatever size you prefer, and then you can do the math and come up with the move per hexes. But that, as since that was kind of in this piece of text, everybody overlooked it, and I've made the mistake, I guess, and a whole lot of other people made the mistake, that you need to take you need to use the number of miles every day and be doing math on the fly to see, like, did I get a third the way into this hex, or did I get half the way into that hex? Yeah. And then at some point, people started making hexless maps where they expected you to use a ruler and then do the scaling with the ruler on the fly. And I think that that's immensely difficult to manage, immensely difficult to figure out, like, visibility and stuff like that. And I'm a big, big proponent of having actual spaces in an actual gamist sense. And it's so much easier to manage. And giving the scales in miles, I think, was a huge mistake that was maintained for quite a while. So I feel
So this adventure particularly falls into that problem, right? And the levels of conflict, like, they're trying clearly to handle every possible case, right? They want complete realism, I suppose, for whatever happens to your players. So you've got all kinds of charts in here about, like, what is the wind like and how does that affect the boat? What kind of boat do they have? Okay. There's so much detail. If I just give you, I'll just give you a little information about this encounter table. If you want to roll for randomly for encounters, how often and what is the chance of an encounter? Well, according to the table, it depends on whether it's day or night and whether or not you are in a populated or remote area. What's a populated area? This tells me populated areas are those within 10 miles of a settlement and the whole length of the Weisbrook Canal. Okay, so now we have 4 entries of day, night, populated or remote. The check is in hours, every 3 hours, every 6 hours, and then you get a percent chance that is somewhere around 5 to 20%. It's a lot.
So
it's
a lot of
cross references. Like that's, I gotta either pre-do a whole lot of math, or I'm gonna really slow the pace of my game as I try to figure this stuff out on the fly.
So I suspect, Paul, that and you and I both love the Moldvay Cook BX rules and stuff like that. I suspect that you haven't had an era in your life like I have, where you really dug into the advanced D&D rules and really attempted to embrace them in all their complexity, because what you just described is almost identical in advanced D&D.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And the encounters are supposed to be every 3 or 6 hours, and there's a particular percentage, and it varies by day or night and area and civilization versus not. So I think that those Warhammer rules in that adventure are very much sharing the DNA of what D&D did coming out of outdoor survival initially, frankly.
So it's not surprising to me that you go from that where, to answer your question, what did I do? And I picked the encounters that were cool and I threw them in when I felt like it.
Yes.
I never once rolled the die. That's what I would have guessed. I just let the force of what's exciting, what's fun right now. And I let that guide me.
Right.
And I just made DM fiat choices. And that so it's not surprising that eventually leads to what we see now. I feel like it was a little more popular in more modern games, where you see the point crawl, right? Where you just have, here's a map, potentially with no scale at all, with just points of interest and connections between those points, and you figure it out. Just do whatever feels right. And before we get too critical of that approach, I will point out that is exactly the approach in our own Dungeon Design Dash Creeping Doom of the game, which I'm showing the map here of right here. Sure enough, we have a map, no scale, a bunch of points that are connected with interesting encounters. Mm-hmm. You and I ran this together as a co-DM game for our good friend Toby. I'm not surprised by that. I liked that. I enjoyed that. I felt like that felt fine and natural to just be like, how many things happen? When does something happen? I don't know. We'll figure it out. We'll make it up as we go.
Now, I will say for viewers that this issue right here is one of the places that Dan and Paul are actually more contentious about than a lot of other stuff in gaming or D&D. And there was probably the time that we were co-DMing many years ago that we had the most contentious moment ever as DMs was specifically us doing some wilderness action and then discovering on the fly that we had completely disparate takes about how we should do that. My personal instinct is to be more systemic, more mechanical, partly because I do want to simulate this big world in action. And in some sense, I don't trust my instincts to be generous or punishing to the players. And so I absolutely do tend to a more simulationist take. And I know that Paul takes a more story-based narrative take. Now, we didn't make this map, right? So we're using this map made by the genius artist Dyson Logos. So it's not like either of us made a choice about that up front. And I'm so glad we did that, because it avoided the debate that we would have had if we were making the map.
All right, so before you and I start to really argue about this, let me give you one other interesting example that we can compare here. It's my most recent example. Most recently, as you know, I've been running a quest game for a small group. And the first module we ran is Blackworm of Brandensford. And I'm just going to quickly put up here. Here's the map that comes with Blackworm of Brandensford. Yeah. I don't know how well this comes up, but like you can see, it's a forest with a big river coming through it. And there are specific, very obvious named points of interest on there. Got Brandensford, the town where we're at. You've got a bunch of other, you know, here's a goblin camp, here's the Witch of the Woods, here's a ruin, you know, here's a barrow mound, etc. The Dragon's Cave is there, right? It's all laid out for you. It does say in the corner there's a scale of inches to miles or something like that. And then there is a page in here of, here's a random encounter table, and you're supposed to roll a d6 for every what is that, each mile that they traverse.
Yeah.
And so when I was running this, I did actually take that map. I'm going to jump back here. I did take that map and put over top of it a hex grid of
points
scale, right?
Yes.
I think I eventually adapted it to I would do... it might be that each hex is half a mile on this grid. But I think every two hexes, I would roll the wandering monster chart. Now, there's some good things and bad things in here. And I'll tell you, you know, from having run this for several sessions, if we jump back to the chart, there's only 12 entries here. One of the entries, fascinatingly, is the dragon. The dragon shows up. The whole reason you're here.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting, right? Because so the way this adventure runs, ostensibly, there's your goal is to find and destroy the dragon, but there's all this other stuff going on. But you could at any point just kind of blunder into the dragon because it's roaming around the forest. And you could just bump into him, which I think is kind of cool and interesting. There are some other encounters in here which are also cool and interesting, but I will say they ran out quick. That what happened was in the first session or so, we got some of the more interesting stuff to show up. And then as we got into later sessions, those things had happened, so it didn't make sense for them to happen again.
Yeah.
And the table kind of dwindled out on me, and the interest of rolling on that chart was less, and there was more momentum for the part. The party was now like, oh, we have objectives. We're trying to get to this thing to do this thing. So pacing-wise, the simulationist approach really started to fight me towards the end. Like as we got further along in the adventure, I was struggling more and more. Like it was still fun to roll the wandering, the what I called the travel die to see if they bumped into something, but the chance of it being something more interesting than what they were pursuing was very low. And I got to the point where I was like, I don't know that this is adding. I think this is actually making the game worse.
Great experience. I had a whole bunch for me to react to there. You know, the most useful in the world is an actual practical playtest. So that's great experience. Here's a very detailed thing that and a lot of what you're talking about is I've also gone through semi recently, like in my Star Frontiers campaign. There's some bits of what you just said I've also had to go through. So here's the thing that I made a mistake initially, and then halfway through my Star Frontiers campaign, and then I adjusted, and I think it was the right call. When you have an encounter on that table and it's been depleted, and then later on, Paul, when you roll for an encounter and then you roll on that table and you duplicate this previously used event, what would you do in that moment? Would you just skip the encounter? Would you re-roll which one it is? Would you pick another one?
One of those, right? So I would usually look at it and I go, oh, that thing definitely happened. It absolutely does not make sense for it to happen again. I might look at the two adjacent entries in the table and say, like, can I just quickly shift by one, pretend that I was off by one? If that doesn't work, maybe I'll re-roll. And then ultimately, if I'm really like, okay, I've spent too much time at this, I've re-rolled three times and it's giving me garbage, I would just like, all right, bamp, something else happens, whatever. Push past it as quickly as possible because there's clearly nothing interesting on here.
I will say that initially I was in my last big campaign, I was doing stuff and then an encounter wouldn't make sense. Initially I was just voiding the encounter. I was like, well, if this can't happen here, I guess nothing happens. And the wilderness wound up feeling like a big void. Is that I wound up repeatedly a lot of time nothing happening. And then I adjusted to I've got to keep the encounter but re-roll which one it is. Which felt a lot better for me. So there's one minor thing that I had to adjust there.
And if you look, one of the problems here is if you look at the Black Worm of Brandenford's, now maybe this is a fault in its chart, right? Is that the things in the chart are often not repeatable. Well, there's something like you see these two goblins, but they're very specifically doing at a thing at a place, right? The goblins are doing this thing at this place. Like encountering them again, that feels terrible, right? So some of them are reusable, but most of them are not.
Right. And now this is a place where you could possibly say, look, by interjecting more narrative story stuff, you're making a problem. And early D&D would just have lists of monsters. They would not have baked in here. It's this name and they're going here and this is their motivation. So I might suggest you get more more mileage out of here's the monsters around here, and like maybe have a separate table of like here's some motivations that things could have in these areas. They're looking for this treasure or this kidnapping victim or something like that, and then you have a larger combination of stuff versus motivations or points of interest, and you can get more mileage out of the permutations of that.
Yeah, that's a good idea, and that definitely that reminds me of there was a table by Jeff Rience, I think, of what are the goblins up to, right? And that was always like a very clever and funny. Built on the idea of like you're in the dungeon, but you're like, okay, I've met another group of D6 goblins. Well, what are they doing? Yes. And that's fun. Yep. So that could be the writing here. It could be a problem with the writing here, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Will you remind me though, let's go back to the other example of our own module that we ran for Toby. Remind me, do you remember what we did in this case? How we handled this? Or like what happens when I travel from point to point? How long does it take? Does anything potentially happen to them?
I could just pull it up here, I think. It might be, I think we put a rule in of either a particular distance on the map, or we might literally have said, do something between each encounter area, which of course folds into the order of the stick joke that we swore to God we weren't going to bring up.
I think you're right. I think one of the things that we struggled with that map, one of the things we struggled with the map was just like, well, how long does it take? Right? How far can they go in a day? And I think we came up with something like, you know, maybe it takes half a day to get from one point to an adjacent one or something like that. And then we got into like, well, are there encounters in between? And we kind of decided like, there's a chance of one thing happening between any two points, and we're just not gonna worry too much about absolute distances and whatnot. Again, because there's no scale on this map. It's all just, I don't know, shrug. Relative. I'm trying to remember I believe, if I remember correctly, it just simply didn't come up that much during play.
Yeah.
I think maybe there was one or two chances during the entire course of the game for something interesting to happen, and nothing really did, and we moved on.
Did we? I mean, okay, now, so I right this second, the version that I'm looking at, I don't see that we have a wandering monster table. I don't see any language here about, I don't know if I'm looking at an early version, but I don't see any language about scale or timing or when to roll at all. And I have a sense, Paul, that when we walked up to the table to run it, we had to have a conversation under our breath at that moment about what we were going to do about that.
I think I want to give us credit for at least having had the foresight to have that conversation in the car on the drive over.
Okay. That's good for us. You know, good for those guys, Paul. That was sharp.
But yeah. You know, some shoddy writing. Like, gosh, man, what did they do? Did they just sit down and like write this whole adventure in an hour, Dan? What's going on here? How do you?
I wonder why they were so rushed.
That is fascinating.
That's so funny. I got an example.
There is a wandering monster chart.
Yeah. I got an example, and your the example from your quest game is great with that. No, initially no hex. You had to add a hex. It was 1 inch is half a mile. So if you put, I have like a gray map. I have a gray map. So this is from a fairly well-regarded adventure module in Dragon Magazine number 57, and I think that's the January 1982 article. And so this is an adventure called The Wandering Trees. And at the time, they actually had a competition called the International Dungeon Design Contest. And so this was the runner-up award winner in the second, this must have happened in 1981, the second International Dungeon Design Contest. When people are selling this particular issue of Dragon Magazine online, they make a big deal out of the fact this is the issue with the Wandering Trees award-winning adventure and stuff like that. And so this was written by a gentleman named Michael Malone, And I knew him as Mike, for what it's worth. I actually worked with Mike for a year or two at a video game company, Papyrus Racing. And I think that part of what caught people's attention and got it the award was that people weren't writing wilderness adventures as a focal point. And the additional novelty that Mike put in, and so it's happening in these woods, and you can kind of see there's kind of a small inset rectangle. It has like a ruin, and if you can get to the ruin, there's a nice treasure there. And so you've got to go through, there's a very elaborate tangle of trails through these woods. And on top of that, the trees are semi-sentient. So every time you go past a particular branching point, they shift around. And if you come back, you've got different options for entrance and exit. So not all of these branching paths are actually available to you all the time. You kind of have this shifting maze effect as you attempt to wend your way through this very confusing, always changing part of the wilderness. Now, you notice a couple things. One, there's no hexes. And two, the scale at the bottom is 1/2 inch per mile. Just exactly like the one that you were looking at, Paul. I dropped this into my last big D&D campaign in a particular location. And I found it difficult. And I think that maybe for players today, if you try to run this literally according to the text as written, I can't imagine that many players are going to find this super satisfying. They're probably going to find this immensely frustrating, because you could wander around kind of semi-randomly on this enormous network of paths for a very, very, very long time, possibly many sessions of encounters if you do it literally. So I did summarize it a bit. I think I snipped some pieces. I also transferred it. Like all these maps that don't have hexes, I always now translate them to hex-based maps, which makes it much, much easier to track, just like Paul did. And, an interesting idea that caught a lot of people's ideas, but I got to admit, trying to measure the actual 1/2 inches along these wandering nonlinear paths was about to drive me crazy. And I'm kind of surprised. I'm slightly, no offense to Mike, who's both a great engineer, super smart programmer, also a super great D&D designer. I'm kind of surprised there was an era where people were doing this kind of hexless stuff with a ruler, because I think there was a version of like the Forgotten Realms campaign set where the map came hexless, but you also had a transparent overlay of hexes. So you could put down the transparent overlay and count hexes when you needed to, which just seems very fiddly to me. So yeah, I'm a big fan of actual hexes.
I'm looking, just amusingly, I was looking at this map next to the Brandenford map, and they're actually slightly inverted from each other. This one appears to be... what is it? Half inch equals 1 mile, and the Brandenford one is 1 inch equals 1/2 mile.
Okay, good point.
Which was fascinating to me, because when you look at that one, I'll just check it up on screen again. The other one, they are big, chunky hexes, and each one of those hexes is 1/2 mile. This is a small map.
It is,
right? And I agree that like a scale in the bottom corner doesn't tell you that. One of the things I like about the hexes is it really gives you that information. And then I want that translated into gameplay, right? I want to know, don't tell me that I'm going to roll for a random encounter every mile, say every 2 hexes. Okay, that makes sense. That's really what I wanted. And that's what I ended up doing.
This is great. Totally agree. I think that if I'm going to criticize node-based adventures or point-based adventures, I think that having a visual map, even from the design aspect, from the DM's perspective, gives you an opportunity to have happy little accidents more and to improvisationally discover stuff. So by sitting down and making a map, your process is top down, is you have some kind of like big shapes, or there's a river here, or there's a coastline here, and then you can fill in more details, and you can fill in more details. If you're doing like a node-based adventure, your design process is more bottom-up, is every detail has to be custom written, and every connection has to be a conscious choice to connect A to B, but not C or D. Whereas when you have a map, it's like, okay, there's a path from A to B, but you know, it went around these mountains, and maybe the players might choose to take the difficult route over the mountains that's shorter, but more risky. And maybe mm-hmm. you discover that there's like a little corner that just suggests, oh, there's a little pocket here between the mountains and the forest, and there's also a swamp right here. Maybe that's an interesting point that jogs my imagination, and now I really want to create a ruin or a lair in this little place. And it's easier to add more details continuously to the graphical map versus the narrative node place style that doesn't give you these happy accidents of connections everywhere. Well,
let me give you here's my counter to that is going to be very specifically the example of Death on the Reich. Again, Death on the Reich came with this giant hex map, but it is chock full of content, great content, so much so that I think the fiddliness of rolling random encounters and chucking that in, you know, especially with all of the very careful math around how fast does a thing go and when, what's the frequency? Like I feel like that stuff is really detracting from Death on the Reich. Death on the Reich is so full of great content. It doesn't need any of that. And I think Death on the Reich would play great as a point crawl. And I think they should just have gone all in on this idea rather than say, well, it's up to you, GM, do what you want. Don't do that. Say instead, here's a list of 6 cool things or 12 cool things that could happen randomly along the river. Not randomly, that could happen along the river that are not important to the plot, but add some extra texture and flavor. Drop them in when you see fit. The end. Done. That's all I need. And then I don't have to feel like I'm not keeping track of the 27 variables that I'm supposed to play this amazing adventure the way it was meant to be played. I don't need that. Not on Death on the Reich, which again I think is just so full of cool stuff. I just any simulationist stuff on top of that is just going to detract. Now, conversely, yes, if we get to say like Creeping Doom of the Pumpkin King, I like that there's a wandering monster table, mm-hmm. and I would like to, you know, yes, I think if I had to go back and spend more than an hour on that. If I was going to do a second iteration on it, yeah, a scale, like put a hex grid on that thing and just a little note of roll randomly on the wandering monster table for X's would be great.
Yeah. And now, I will certainly agree that, you know, game products, role-playing game products that say, maybe you do this, maybe you do that. It's up to you. I think is a road bump for me all the time. And I do prefer people to make a choice, right? Make a choice one way or the other, and the product is this kind of thing, and you're not trying to kind of halfway offer this. Like for me, second edition AD&D falls into that same trap a lot of the time. Sometimes that's because you're at an evolutionary point, actually, and there's these new design instincts that are coming up that people haven't switched to entirely, and they're not entirely convinced about which way the audience is going to want it. I will say that if you have a team of, you know, you're maybe someone more creative than I am possibly that can tailor all of these interesting individual custom encounters, that's one thing. But for the, you know, hobbyist DM that has limited time, it's maybe more efficient to come up with a system to generate stuff on the fly and then improvisationally explain it or connect it on the fly as the DM is themselves surprised by what things or beings or places are popping up. And, you know, there's always a cycle of people rediscovering that kind of play. But, there, you know, just for the busy, harried DM, you might be better off starting off with a system and then adding maybe one or two more custom pieces as they come up. And then maybe at some point, maybe the system didn't make any sense at that point.
I think ultimately what I want is just be opinionated. When you're writing this stuff, be opinionated.
Yeah.
Go in a direction. Like I like the point crawls that are being published these days because it is opinionated, right? They've made a choice. They said, you know what? It's just points. There are interesting things along the points. The end. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about scale and distance and blah, blah, blah. If you want to go more simulationist, great. Give me hexes. Give me tables to roll on. But simplify the crap out of it, please. The point of having a hex map is that I don't have to measure and think about how many miles per day does a person on foot versus a person on a horse go. Like, just give me a quick table that says, you know, on foot you go one hex per day. On a horse you go three hexes, whatever it is. Just give me the numbers. and then tell me how frequently to roll on the table.
Where I came to original D&D at a late era was a huge breath of fresh air. Right. Oh my God, the moves are in number of hexes. Oh, it's thank God, finally, right? which is funny because that was the inception. And then that's one of the biggest mistakes that Gary made moving to advanced D&D is that he got away from that, and then everybody took that first edition system and made it complicated in exactly the way that you're complaining about, Paul. So I couldn't agree more with it. You know, that part's a game. I like a map. I'm a bit of a visual person. I can remember it more. I can remember the whole thing if it's a nice graphical map. I like showing it to my players, and I like it being kind of gamist. I tell the players what the move rates are. I tell them what the encounter tables are half the time, and I like that part being very clearly, you know, kind of gamist.
Yeah. I don't mind that. You know, to go back to Brandonsford, right? This what I ultimately did is I gave the players the map without the hexes on it, and I just said, here it is, here's the map.
Same.
Do what you will with that. Which was great, right? Like, I mean, it feels like a spoiler because right up there in the top left corner is the freaking dragon cave, right? Like, it's clearly that's where the dragon is. But, you know, I came up with a good in-game reason of like, yep, there was another adventurer. He scouted some stuff out. He's now terrified and never wants to go out there again, but he drew this map and give that to them. And then I had the hex map on my own, so that I could count distances of how they were traveling. And I almost wonder in retrospect, like I probably could have just given them the hex map and just told them like, yep, every two hexes, you got to roll the travel die. That's how the game works. And then let them draw their own paths and figure out what they were doing. And I would say and the hexes, like, yeah, okay. You could get away with not doing the hexes and just use a ruler. But I think the hexes are easier. Right. I don't need a separate implement. And then the only thing that I will complain about in Brandonsford is that the wandering monster table was too the encounters were too specific. They were too tied down specific things so that they quickly the table quickly exhausted itself.
It's a danger that, you know, in some sense you're underestimating how big the outdoors is because that's a technique that could totally make sense in a small dungeon. Of like, there's only 12 things wandering around, and these are the characters involved, and this is what they're doing. But if you take that same sensibility to the outdoors, you're wildly underestimating just how big this area is, and it kind of doesn't make sense to be specific like that. Now I know that we're running low on time, so we don't need to pull up the image. I'm complaining about products that go, you could do this, you could do that, but amusingly, you know, that's in original D&D. So even at the outset, there are two different, Gary/Dave have two different methods for interacting with the wilderness. And one is you pull up the outdoor survival map, you show it to the players, they get to choose how they navigate around it, and you roll for random adventures and random monsters. And the second way that they call the referee's map here, it says the referee's map is a wilderness map unknown to the players. It should be for the territory around the dungeon location. When players venture into this area, they should have a blank hex map. And as they move over each hex, they get informed, they fill it in, this form of exploring will ultimately let the players choose where to build their castles. And it says these exploratory adventures are likely to be the most exciting, and their incorporation into the campaign is most desirable. And I gotta say, my experience is the opposite. When people are wandering around a blank map and they don't really have any particular reason for making choices in one direction or the other, they're not super engaged. Again, it's the whole problem. Are you making interesting choices? And for my money, again, I believe that at the outset, but what I've discovered, you know, over and over again, is that giving the players more information, actually showing them the whole map, like you do and like I do now, Paul, lets players make these decisions and decide, am I going to get there this way? Am I going to get there that way? And I'm finding that the initial, you know, version A of their wilderness rules, that, and I run it sometimes at our house conventions. We call it outdoor spoliation, and I try to run it as close to the original D&D rules as possible on the outdoor survival map. I find that seems to get a lot more excitement than the wandering around and exploring a blank map.
Yeah, I basically agree with that. I mean, I understand where you're coming from with the blank map, because you're trying to, I really want you to feel that immersion, because you don't have an aerial view of the space and you want to, like, you're trying to figure it out, right? And that's where you get weird stuff like the Lost Roll, which frankly, I can't say I've ever had fun with the Lost Roll.
Okay, right? Well, I mean, so it's in outdoor survival, right?
Yeah, I know.
So it's in outdoor survival, and it makes sense of, you know, do you have more, do you have less navigation ability? Now again, see, and again, I think this is a mistake. So what the outdoor survival rule is that if your navigation isn't great, then for today, you don't get to choose where you move. You move a particular move in a straight line. You can't make any turns because you got screwed up. But it's not like you don't know where you are, right? The problem with like the advanced D&D is now all of your mapping now becomes misaligned, and you're fundamentally, you're spending an arbitrary amount of time filling in a false map, right? And then at some point when you discover that, you have to pull out an eraser and erase like half a page of marks. That's not the original rule. The original rule is just one unchosen move, and then you know where you are at the end of the day. You're not an idiot. Right. You know where the sun came up. You don't think you're moving north you don't think the sun's suddenly coming up in the south. Nobody's that stupid. Yep. And the next day you just have to deal with the location where you are that you didn't want to be.
You're just kind of hand waving over the period of time when you were lost, right? You're immediately jumping from you lose track of where you are to like, I just realized I'm here instead of where I meant to be. Okay, now how do I readjust? Yeah, that's clever.
That makes a lot more sense. That's how I run it.
We are out of time. Any final thoughts on outdoor adventures?
I like maps. I like the maps. I like the original way. And when I say the original way, I kind of mean the outdoor survival way. I'm actually not super fond of how that got adjusted in D&D. The way the encounters work, and the blank map, and the getting lost on a blank map, and the non-hex based movement, I think were all additional missteps, frankly. So I like a game, I like a graphic, I like more information, I like putting the map out in front of the players and letting them make choices on the hexes. And for my money, that's still the best gameplay that I got out of the wilderness.
I would at least I enjoy that. I will say I definitely enjoy that. I also enjoy point crawls. I think point crawls can be quite fun. I think the design, when you're designing an outdoor adventure, you just need to be opinionated on which direction you want to go here, and recognize that certain mechanics lean in certain directions, right? That having a hex map, having wandering monster or random encounter charts, that you're leaning in a more simulationist way, and you just need to embrace that, right? I think it gets messed up when we look at things like Death on the Reich or the Black Worm of Brandensford, where you're kind of co-mingling randomness with very opinionated story-based content. It doesn't work super well. So I like the story-based content, but just lean in. I say, make it a point crawl. Just go with it, and don't bother trying to say like, oh yes, but also we have these other mechanics that are countermanding the style of the game that I'm trying to write.
I agree you should pick one or the other. Yeah, I do.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know which one you should pick, but...
Oh, dear. And viewers, you know, viewers, if you have opinions, if you agree with Dan, or if you want to argue that that there is a truer form that combines all of the different mechanics, or if you're a little annoyed that our outdoor adventure topic kind of went down this particular path, because I do feel like it was a very broad topic and we could have gone a lot of different directions here.
Yeah,
if there's stuff that we didn't cover that you want to hear about, please leave us a comment in the YouTube video. We'd love to hear from you. Maybe we'll have a topic for another episode down the road.
Definitely, definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, TikTok, Loops, GitHub. We have the handle WanderingDMs on all the sites, so please look for us there and reconnoiter that like button.
If you prefer to listen to this show in audio-only podcast format, you can do so. Those podcasts are available on our website at wanderingdms.com and also through various third-party carriers like iTunes and Spotify and Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on a third-party carrier and it gives the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really do, and of course, huge thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, then like Paul said at the top of the hour, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Every tier gets you access to our private Discord server where the conversation continues around the clock on all kinds of different games, role-playing, horror, science fiction, miniature modeling, all that kind of stuff. We have the best, smartest patrons with some of the best, most creative ideas. And if you drop stuff in there, they might very well spawn future shows here as well. Don't forget that, again, we are at GaryCon in 2 weekends' time. Again, if you're there and you want to join in our next Dungeon Design Dash and help us come up with the next Creeping Doom of the Pumpkin King or whatever it is, we would love to see you there. We'll also be doing that online at the same time, assuming the technology works out. And we are also at Rising Phoenix Game Con in April, and we're doing similar stuff there. So we would love to meet you there. That's the stuff that we are focused on. We will be back next week on March 15th. So look for us there. I think that's the important stuff. That's the important stuff, right, Paul?
Mike, looking the important stuff. Improve.
Have I gotten lost with all the exciting stuff that's upcoming on our point crawl?
No, you're good.
So viewers, don't forget, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time, and we hope you'll join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.